Hello, I'm Katrina Fox. Since recording this podcast, you can now find a lot of my content for vegan businesses, including my Vegans in the Limelight PR course, as part of veganbusinesstribe.com. If you're a vegan leader of any kind and want to connect with me directly to help you use strategic storytelling to ethically influence your audience, then please visit katrinafox.com. I hope you enjoy the show.
Are you a vegan who views your business as your form of activism? If so, Vegan Business Tribe has hundreds of hours of masterclasses, courses, guides, and podcasts to help you grow a vegan business that doesn't just make a profit, but makes an impact too. Just head over to veganbusinesstribe.com and also claim a free 20-minute coaching call when you sign up.
Welcome to Vegan Business Talk with Katrina Fox, author of Vegan Ventures, Start and Grow an Ethical Business. Hello and welcome to episode 59 of Vegan Business Talk. I'm Katrina Fox, journalist, author, media and PR coach, copywriter, editor and proofreader, and founder of Vegan Business Media, a content, events and training platform providing success tips for vegan business owners and entrepreneurs. In this episode, I interview Susie Push, owner of handbags and accessories company Bungalow 360 in California. Bungalow 360 is renowned for its whimsical animal themes, exemplifying the company's commitment to protecting the planet's species and environment. Products are crafted of natural cotton canvas and printed with water-based inks. The line consists of handbags, wallets, kids' accessories, and vegan leather items, with a new bamboo line in the works. Susie started out handcrafting the bags herself nearly 20 years ago in 1998 while working as a receptionist at Mossimo, a trendy lifestyle brand in California. She learned about sales and distribution, which came in handy when she decided to quit her job and work full-time on Bungalow 360. Her products are available in around 2,000 independent boutiques, gift shops, and health food stores across the US. And she operates the business from her home on a farm in Fallbrook, California. Bungalow 360 is big on sustainability, using alternative energy sources such as solar, and it's known for its philanthropy towards animal causes. As well as financial donations to various animal advocacy organisations, the company also provided solar panels to the Gentle Barn Animal Sanctuary. In this interview, Susie talks about why she doesn't follow trends when designing her products, why she manufactures her products in China rather than the US, be prepared to set aside any preconceived ideas you may have around this, why she decided to stop selling her products to department stores such as Nordstrom and deliberately kept her business smaller, how she handled other companies stealing her designs, how she used guerrilla marketing tactics to raise her brand profile and make sales, and much more. Here's the interview with Susie Push of Bungalow 360. Hello, Susie. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Hi, how are you?
Fantastic. And I'm very excited and looking forward to speaking with you today because you've got such a great story that I know listeners are going to be very inspired by. So the very first question I always kick off with everyone, so let's start there, is why? You know, what's the reasons for running your vegan business? Why do you do it?
That's a really deep question because it started without a plan. I had no business plan and I just wanted to be creative and have fun. And so everything kind of evolved from that. I started out as a handcrafted business, just finding cool fabric and then sewing up one-of-a-kind bags and then selling them at the farmer's market and college campuses and flea markets. And I kept a day job while I did that. And I did that for about 3 to 5 years. And surprisingly, that was very competitive at the time because we didn't have social media. We didn't have Etsy. So, you know, I'm in California, so we had LA and we have these in San Diego. So there's lots of opportunities to go out and sell your product on campuses and such. But that was a lot of fun. I really got to know my customers, and then kind of where I wanted to go with my business was all because I did it that way, as opposed to having a plan in place. You know,
right.
I don't think I would have been successful if I had a plan in place. But
got
because
it.
Of the way I did it, I learned so much from just going out there and doing it. So that's kind of my story.
For sure. Wow. So that's lovely. So you had that, obviously, that creative aspect, and you came from that real kind of creative point of view. And obviously, you made your bags vegan, you know, because of the passion. And I love how you've managed to, yeah, turn that into a business. Like, 'cause I think that's very inspiring for people to hear. And I know some people listening, or some, you know, business expert will be listening and saying, oh, gosh, you didn't have a business plan. That's terrible. So I love that you're a really good example of, you know, sometimes you just kind of go with the flow and it can work out. So that's fantastic. So tell us a little bit about the story. But we've mentioned a little bit about the brand itself. What about the name Bungalow 360? I'm curious about that.
Well, it's I was working at a day job at a company called Mossimo. He's a surf brand out here in California. He became quite successful, and he moved. He was like the first designer to move his product into Target. So I was their receptionist there, and on the side, I was making my bags, and someone in the accounting department was like, do you want to have a home party? And I'm like, what's that? And they're like, oh, you just bring your bags and I'll throw a party and we'll bring some girls over. And that night I sold out. And so word kind of got around in the office that I was doing this. And one of the designers came up to me and she's like, you really need to put a label on your bag and you need to have a name. And I would not have thought of that unless she told me to do that. So then I went home and I was like, I lived in Laguna and I was living in a bungalow and my address was 360. And I'm just like, and that's where I was being that little creative person, was in my little bungalow. And so that's how I got the name, you know. And it's funny, 20 years later, to see that number 360 being used on everything. It's kind of exciting because I was, you know, I used it 20 years ago when no one was really using it. And now it's kind of everywhere. So
right. Well, that's lovely. I love hearing that story because everybody's got such a different way, you know, of coming up with their brand name. You know, and some people kind of spend forever kind of coming up with something. And I love that, you know, you've just kind of went, OK, I live here and this is my number. I'm just going to go with this. And,
right. Not knowing that 20 years later, we'd still be using it. And
yeah.
I actually went home that day and I found some like iron-on paper that you get at, you know, the computer store. And I was making labels by ironing them onto fabric and then cutting them out and sewing them onto my bags. That's how I first
wow.
started doing my labels.
Fantastic.
And the funny thing about Mossimo was I worked there when I was in my 30s, and I had gone to, like, I was working in the restaurant industry, and I was kind of getting burnt out of the restaurant industry. So I thought, I went to a temp agency. And I took all the tests that, you know, you have to do, like typing and spelling.
Yes.
And I failed them all. But the ladies were in a huddle and they're like, what are we going to do with her? And I was like, I just want to do something creative. And I was really naive, like, and they're like, eyes would roll. I'm like, oh my gosh. And so finally I'm like, I can answer a phone really good. And so then they literally gave me these papers and said, go here, go to this address. And that's where I had my interview at Mossimo. So that's kind of
fantastic.
And the unique thing about that was when I was there, he was about to go under. Like his business was about to go under. He had some manufacturing issues, and he had brought in the guy that used to be the CEO at Tommy Hilfiger and Ralph Lauren. And so all these people were there in this office trying to build this company back. And I was like there in the center of it. So I was like a sponge, you know.
Nice.
I don't have any, you know, schooling or business classes or anything like that. But to me, that was my school, you know,
to
be around all that. And, you know, to see the accounting department, like they seriously had an accounting department of like 15 people that were just calling the big department stores who were late on payment. You know, so I immediately knew, oh, I'm only going to take credit cards. So I've never really extended 30-day net to any customers except for like Smithsonian, you know, someone who's very much been around and they're going to pay. So that's one lesson to learn. Don't give 30-day net, you know,
that's
unless you really know who the customer is. So
got it. So does that include wholesalers then, Susie? So you,
that's who, yeah.
Front.
Well, that's my business for now. Like we only do wholesale.
You don't sell to the public anymore.
Yeah, we only sell to stores technically. And then I'll do a farmer's market, or I'll do a veggie fest, or I'll do something like that where I go out and sell it to the customer. But it's not something I do as, you know, I just do that for fun to keep in touch with our customers.
Oh, cool. So they can't buy online or anything then? It's literally just through the stores?
Well, you know, we can't. You can buy online. We haven't updated our website in years. We just did. So that was an interesting thing because we kept debating, because I'd get hate mail like, oh, your website sucks. And, you know, because we couldn't, you couldn't see it on your iPhone, because we, like my husband built the website and he only knew so much technology to build it. And then we looked into hiring people. We just didn't like the way it looked or felt. So we just kind of didn't go forward with it. But in the meantime, Amazon came about. So what was happening was, like, our stores would buy from us and then they'd put up on Amazon. So then I was able to go to our customers like, oh, our website's outdated. You can go to Amazon. And for a while, that was like working fantastic for us, because then Amazon had to deal with all the customer service and the shipping and all that. But now we've had to kind of, just in the last couple of months, we've realized that it's like the Wild West out there on Amazon. And there's some things that we have to go back up and clean up just so that our product gets represented correctly on Amazon. And then we have an updated website too, which we're really happy about. So, but it's not, wasn't one of those most important things to us, because we were dealing mostly with wholesale.
With wholesale, right. So even with wholesale, then you basically require advance payment and they're okay with that rather than the credit, 30-day credit.
Yeah. I mean, because we don't sell to any department stores right now. That's a whole another beast, is selling to department stores. So we sell to, like, you know, we sell to like lots of touristy areas and environmental stores and vegan stores, and because our product has very whimsical animal graphics and so that's kind of our customer. It's not like we're selling to Whole Foods, even though we have in the past. It's just you kind of need a full staff to deal with department stores, where we're kind of in that sweet spot where we've been doing business long enough that we have our customers, we bring in the product, and then we sell it to, you know, we kind of know what we're going to sell through, and we keep it small. I've kept my business small, which is, it's a hard thing to do.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, actually. So you've deliberately kept it small.
Right. One of my, like, when I was selling at one of the flea markets, these guys came by and they asked me to do a custom bag for them. And then, I did, and he loved it. And then he asked me to do 200 bags. He actually owned a makeup company. And I was like, cool, I will, if I can keep my, you know, at the time I wasn't in any stores yet. I'm like, if I can, keep my hang tag on the bag, just so I get a little bit of promotion, since he wanted me to put his label on the bags. So he used to do this for his top accounts. He would send them at the end of the year, like a goodie bag. And so I did that. And then all of a sudden, Nordstrom's calls me and wants to order bags. And I was like, oh my gosh, how exciting. And so I'm like, I just went for it, not knowing what it was going to be about. And it was like, for me, it was just not, I mean, there I am selling 200 bags myself of the same bag. And then, like, the whole process of, you know, it has to be labeled correctly. And then there's just so many, much paperwork and rules. And, you know, it's just, to me, I'm like, that's not fun anymore. So I kind of thought, you know what, I don't, you know, there's other ways you can sell, like, to different stores other than the department stores. Because they kind of, if you're a small company, they can just eat you up and spit you out, you know.
Especially if you can't make your sharing this. Yeah, this is,
especially if you can't make your deliveries, you know. And we have great sales, so I'm not, you know, we're happy with where we are right now. It's not like, you know, I know we probably as a business could be making a lot more money, but it's at what cost, you know. And then
that's a really my job, good point.
And my job then becomes someone who is managing people and employees, and all that creativity that goes into my product gets sucked out, you know. That's just my how my view
That's
is.
Fantastic. Now, I love that you're sharing. This is really good because, like you said, there are very different business models and it's what works for you. And sometimes there's an assumption that, oh, if I start my own business, you know, the goal is to make it as, you know, big as possible. But that's not necessary. Like you say, at what cost? You know, if it's a cost to your soul or your health or, you know, whatever other aspect of your life, then, you know, it's maybe not the way to go. So I love that you've, yeah, deliberately done that. So did you fulfill that thing with Nord? Like, did you initially go with department stores and then realize, oh no, this is not the way I go, and then pull back?
Yeah, no, I did. I did do the, we sold to maybe 10 different Nordstroms. And then it came down to, I think they needed UPC codes, which was very expensive at the time. And I said, well, I don't really want to pay for the UPC codes. And it just kind of went away. And then we did sell to, and then that was when I was still hand making them. And then I found a manufacturer and I started, I had the opportunity to design our own fabric, which really set us apart from all the other companies that were like me, who got the same fabric and were selling the same type of bag out there at the farmer's market. Now I had the opportunity to put our own graphics that nobody else had on our bags. And that's kind of when we kind of got really into a lot of stores. I just lost my thought. Where was I going with that?
Just about the initially you went with the department stores, but then.
Oh, yeah. And so we did. So I did. I was doing a lot of trade shows, mostly in the gift market. Whole Foods did order from us and we did sell to them. And it was fine. But it came back to that thing where at the time we had, you know, 1,000 other stores that were so easy. And then this one would just slow us down because of all the requirements. And so then I was like, you know, it just doesn't feel right to me, you know?
Yeah.
So that's kind of, so it happened twice where I had that opportunity. And so basically at the trade shows, if Walmart or one of those big department stores came up, I would just say, I can't sell to you. And they would just walk away. So,
wow. It's amazing. It's so kind of good to hear this because I can hear people, you know, sort of listening to thinking, oh my God, but you know, but it is, it's about what is right for you. So in that case, because you talked about some of the, oh, sorry, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you, yeah, sorry.
Oh, okay, cool. It's all right. Now, this is brilliant. I'm really glad you're sharing this because, you know, it just really shows that, you know, you can walk away from these big clients, you know, these big, these big customers, potential customers, and still have a successful business and stay true to yourself. And so I really love that you're sharing. This is a fantastic story. So you've talked about, I guess, some of the challenges when you first started up. I think you've sort of covered some of those aspects. So in terms of the, when you're supplying to stores now, like you say, you know, you supply wholesale now to the independent stores or eco stores, vegan stores. So do you kind of handle that all yourself still, or do you have like a, some kind of like you work with a wholesaler and distributor so that they take care of all that paperwork type stuff?
No, we do all that ourselves. We have a 3-person team here. It's my husband. And then we have a sales manager who we brought on maybe 2 years ago. So we do all that ourselves. We receive the shipment. And what's unique with the, when we get a shipment, we need like 10 really strong guys here. And we're lucky that we're in a, like a near a military town. So we hire Marines to come out for the day and help unload the container. Cause we're on a 2-acre farm running our business out of, you know, like a home-based type business, but it's, you know, on a farm that we've kind of made into a business venture. So we don't go to an office every day.
Fantastic. Wow. So again, I love the way you're fitting this whole thing into your lifestyle, which is awesome. So that's great. So now, look, you touched on the manufacturing side of things. So I believe you still initially design your bags. And at one point, obviously, you were hand making them. And then you had to, you know, find a factory or an outlet to make them for you. Now, what I find interesting is that, you know, there's a lot of emphasis in, particularly in ethical circles, on buying locally made goods, you know, the whole made in the US say, mm-hmm. is seen as signs that you're supporting the local economy and being more environmentally friendly, and probably even more so nowadays with a certain new president. But your products are actually made in China, and mm-hmm. you've got a unique perspective on this. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I absolutely support locally sourced, you know, anything and sustainability and all of that. And when we first started making our product, once we started getting a little bigger, I went to downtown LA, and unfortunately, the only thing left in LA right now is, and this is, I haven't, you know, manufactured in LA in over 10 years. So, that's how it was then. I don't know if things have changed, but I don't think so. But all that was in America were pretty much sweatshops, in the sense of, like, I even went to, like, the Fashion Institute. And I was like, do you have a list of factories that are good that aren't sweatshops? And the lady goes, there's no such thing down here. Wow. And then I found some guys that said they would, you know, make the bags for me and stuff. And it just was a really bad experience for me. I had my fabric stolen, I had products stolen, and then when I'd go in there, it just was not the conditions that one would think are made in USA. It's not like there's, you know, this magical college student sewing bags. They're all, you know, mostly immigrants that probably aren't getting paid a fair wage, but it's in USA. And that's why I never understood how, oh, made in USA is so great. It's different if you go to a local farmer's market and there's a girl there that's hand sewing her bags. But I'm talking about now, when you turn that into something where you need to produce a little more.
Right.
And I was just never able to source or find a place that could do that for me. I had places that could maybe sew, but I'd have to source the hardware, the fabric, everything overseas. When I was approached by some manufacturers at a trade show, they were from India, and I was not keen on doing anything overseas at all. And they were just like, oh, we take on one small company a year, and we've decided you're it, and they gave me this whole line. And so I'm like, what do I have to lose? You know, they're not going to make me pay up front, so if it doesn't come in right, I just won't pay. And so I entered a relationship with them, and it was a nightmare. They didn't deliver on time. The buckles came in rusted, and it was just like, oh my God. Like, I was in tears. I'm like, I can't do this anymore. But then I got through that. And then I, you know, went to a competitor that was, you know, they were living in America, but they owned a factory in China. And I asked, you know, started talking to them about this and how their factory was and everything. And they started making our bags for us, and we're still with them. The way China usually works, like, if you're a big company, is you'll get a job, and then you'll have like six different manufacturers, and you'll let everyone know that job's available. And usually the way, you know, it goes is whoever comes in the cheapest and the fastest turnaround gets that job. And that's where you run into problems, I think, with sweatshops and unethical factories and stuff. But,
right.
You know, our factory is, they have karaoke nights, they get fed. It's just like, the factories in China are really different than how people do business over here. We're really happy to be working. I mean, for me, I see it more as we're one planet, one world. We're like living in a globalized nation. It's not, you know, planet USA, it's planet Earth. So, you know, and, you know, I've gotten hate mail over the years because people assume that we're made in the USA, and then they find a China label. And I'm always like, well, how did you email me? Was it on a computer, an iPhone? Because those aren't made in America. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So how are you picking and choosing what gets made? And, you know, we try really hard to make sure that all the, you know, things are in place, that the employees are being taken care of, and things are done in the best way that they can be. And we're not gouging for prices and stuff like that. So,
I love that. I love that, because there are those assumptions, aren't they? It's like, you know, you see that all made in China and you immediately think, oh, there's, you know, 6-year-old children sitting there, you know.
Well, and I think that's how it used to be. I really do think that that's how it used to be. But they really, you know, that all became in the public eye years ago, and they cleaned it up. I mean, I'm not saying that all factories are perfect, because I'm sure there's a plenty that aren't. But
yeah.
The one I use, I'm very happy with. And then I always thought, like, I would look at, there's a company in California, in LA called American Apparel. I'm like, how did he do it? How did he figure out how to do it in America? And maybe about 5 years ago, there was this huge report how they found that 90% of his staff were illegal immigrants. And so he lost his whole, he almost went out, I think they actually went out of business. I'm not sure what happened, but not because of this, but they, there was a thing on the news, like, if you need a job, all you have to do is show that you can work this equipment. And they, no one was showing up for these jobs in America. So it's, I think that, you know, you have to kind of, technology comes in and takes over jobs, and then other jobs are formed. And, you know, I just have a different way of looking at it. But the reason he was able to do it in America was he was because the majority of his staff was not, it wasn't like people were going to college to become factory workers. You know, that's not happening. So, you know, it's, I think there's a conversation that still needs to be done regarding all of this, you know, and we're definitely having it here in America due to our election that we had. So, so.
Good. No, I'm really glad that you shared that. Yeah, no, I really like that. I like that you shared that and that you challenged those assumptions. Like, you've literally kind of turned that on its head. Like you said, you know, actually, the made in the USA, you know, a lot of those are actually sweatshops. And whereas, you know, your factory that you're using in China is actually ethical. So I think it's important for us to know, you know, not to make assumptions. And I love that you explain that very clearly on your website. You've got a link to where it says made in China, and then you've got for more info. Because when I saw it, I was like, oh, made in China, really? You know, I had that kind of that similar reaction. And then I clicked through and I read, and I was like, cool, fair enough. And I think that really helps to educate your customers, you know, rather than like then having them, like you say, you know, sending you hate mail, like, oh, how come they're made in China, is to really explain that. And I love that you do that thoroughly on your website, as well as sharing that here. So that's fantastic. Thank you. So look, in terms of competition, Susie, like I say, you've been around for a long time, like you say, 20 years. And nowadays there are, you know, there's a much more diverse range of vegan bags and accessories. How do you go about continuing to stand out both within and outside the vegan business arena and maintaining a regular flow of customers?
Yeah, for us, it's pretty easy because we copyright all of our graphics. So, you know, early on, we did get knocked off on our graphics, and we got in one of the top copyright attorneys and we sued them. I don't like doing stuff like that, but you kind of have to send a message like, we have an attorney, stop doing that. In all three cases, we won because it was just right out, they knocked off our graphics. The difficult part is you can't really copyright design. So I've had many people who have copied our design, like something that we sat down and sketched out and designed ourselves that was unique to our company. We've had bigger companies steal that that design. And there's not a lot we can do with that. And so I'm all for competition, like, tons of bag companies are competing. I just don't like that people steal other people's ideas and claim it as theirs. And like, I've had verbiage stolen from me, which is, I'm like, why would you do that? That has nothing to do with you, you know, like, but I learned that early on, because even though I was selling at the Rose Bowl flea market and the Fairfax flea market, it was very like eye-opening that, you know, I would, you know, share a booth with someone who has jewelry, and I'd tell them where I got my fabric, and I was like very naive. And, you know, the next month I'd show up, and that jewelry girl had her own booth and was selling bags just like mine also. So it was one of those things where you start, like, I started to be very protective of our product. And like when I did trade shows, like, everyone thought I was crazy because I would cover my booth up completely. Like, you'd have a little door that you could go in. I'd make it look like a little bungalow. And like, all the, you know, everyone was like, you're crazy. Why are you covering your stuff up? And I'm like, because if someone is a buyer, that's going to make them want to go in. But if you're someone that wants to copy, or you don't want to make your presence known that well.
Right.
And so that for me always worked. Because when you put yourself out there at a trade show, it's your product's out there. And, you know, there's big companies search trade shows just to get ideas and stuff.
Right.
So that, I mean, that's part of every business. I think if you have a good idea and you're successful, you're always going to have that. And you just have to have a good, you know, attorney in place in case someone gets too close. And you have to just go after them. You know, that's just But that's the only bad part of the business that I really don't like.
So I guess in terms of standing out, you use very unique designs, and over the years you've built up that customer loyalty so that people recognize your brand. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, because we don't go, oh, anchors are in, let's do anchors. No, we're more of what's not out there. What are we feeling? Like a woodpecker might come up to my window and I'm like, oh my gosh, you're so cute, let's do woodpeckers, you know. We haven't done koala bears yet, so that's a possibility.
Oh. Koalas, you know,
so whatever, you know, I just kind of when it's time, I'm like, I have ideas going on percolating, and then I kind of like settle on certain things, and we go forward with them.
Cool. So in terms of then the marketing and the PR side of things, you know, getting it out there, obviously this was more when you started out, it was pretty much pre-internet or just on the cusp of, you know, the internet
right.
becoming quite big. So what have been some of the marketing strategies that you've used that have been successful in growing Bungalow 360?
Well, early on, I always thought, oh, I have to get it in the hands of celebrities and all that kind of stuff. And we did, like, I would do like a chili festival in Malibu, which, you know, 85% of the customers are celebrities that would come out. So we got our hands into, you know, that way. But nowadays it's different because every celebrity has their own brand. So I would not suggest people send product to celebrities. And I think with social media nowadays, that's where you can really stand out and, get a lot of PR by just building a fan base up. But I've never really used a marketing company or a PR firm. I've just kind of, you know, done crazy stuff like guerrilla marketing stuff that, you know, and
Such
just a, being out at the
example?
Market. Let's see, what was... Okay, so we did, there's a surfing competition here in California called the U.S. Open, and it brings out thousands of people. And I told my friend, I'm like, we have a van that has our prints on it, that has our logo really big, and I'm like, let's get down there really early and just park the van out there and drive around and promote the, you know, handout bags and stuff. So we got up at like 3 a.m, and we get there at 4 a.m., and... we park our car, and I don't know how this was even able to happen, at the entrance. So it caused quite a commotion. There was all these guys on walkie-talkies, and they're like, what is she doing here? And I was just like, I just got, this is the parking place that was available. And it was really kind of genius because there was a guy that came out from a tanning lotion company. He's like, I had to pay $80,000 for a booth. If you leave, you tell me, I'm going to bring my car here. And I'm like, I'm not leaving, you know? And so it caught, and I was like, oh, because I didn't plan on that happening, but I just kind of had an idea to go down there, and that, you know, stuff like that happens, you know, when you don't have a plan that, oh, I'm going to do this, this, and this, just kind of get in the car and go. But I know that I knew I could only do that once. Like I couldn't show up the next day and do that because they had it roped off and we're like, that darn girl. But, you know, so stuff like that. And I also think just going, like, if, you know, you really want, if you have a higher end branding, we want to get it in certain people's hands, then kind of go to them, like doing the farmer's market in Malibu or parking your car on Coast Highway in Malibu, you're going to get a lot of attention that way. That doesn't cost you anything if you're just starting out, you know. But I have, I mean, if you, you know, if you can afford a good PR company, I would say go for it because that they do that. They're really good with words and they can really, you know, or they have those connections that can get you the type of, get you in the hands of people that they work with.
Yeah, for sure. Now, you touched on social media. So did you embrace that quite early on? Susie?
No, I didn't. And I wish I would have because I was kind of late to the game. So I never really got into Twitter and I'm still not, but I started to get into Facebook and I was like loving it. Like we had a huge fan base. There was all this communication and people were asking questions and I was communicating with them. And then he did the whole algorithm thing and kind of cut businesses off and you have to pay for it now. So now I'm loving Instagram, but you know, it's, it's not quite as big of a base as I have built on Facebook. So, but I think it's great. Instagram and Facebook still.
Yeah. It's just kind of interesting because I know that there's companies out there, you know, like, you know, starting up their own businesses, and they're kind of, do you know what I mean? I say, because there's more competition, there's more vegan, you know, like vegans become more popular. So there's more ethical and vegan brands coming out. And it's always that, you know, well, how do I, you know, get that customer loyalty and what have you? So it's interesting to hear from your perspective as a brand that's been around for a long time. And obviously you got a lot of that from literally physically going out to places, like you mentioned, trade shows and veg fest and events and gift shows and stuff like that, and then coming on and using social media as well. So it's just interesting, yeah, to find out those kind of strategies, particularly for an existing brand. So
yeah, no, I feel they have a much easier time now to get, because I mean there's a lot of vegan bloggers that have huge followings, like hundreds of thousands of them. So I think there's like a built-in marketplace for a vegan company where, you know, we're vegan, but when I started my business, I wasn't vegan. We were more of an environmental company, and we were donating solar panels and stuff like that. Even though we were donating to animal causes, I didn't really start using the word vegan until we started our vegan. We started making vegan leather bags.
Oh, cool. Okay. And when was that?
The vegan leather bags we started making about 3 years ago.
Oh, okay, right. Because I was going to ask you about the use of the word vegan in your marketing materials, because I noticed it's up there on your website under the vegan leather. So what are your thoughts now, particularly as you've been in business for so long, about, you know, the use of the word, how much to use the word vegan on your marketing materials or not, and whether that's changed as you
Yeah, know. Well, on the vegan leather, I do, because it looks like real leather. It feels like real leather. And I still get to the point where people are like, are you sure this isn't leather? I'm like, it's vegan. So I purposely use it on that. And then other people that come in and they're like, oh, this is a beautiful leather bag. I say, no, it's vegan. And they're like, what's that? And I explain to them. And then on our hang tags, it says that we promote a plant-based diet, because I just think it's just a no-brainer. It's, you know, it's environmental, you're helping animals, and it's for your health. I got a certificate in plant-based nutrition from Cornell University, oh gosh, years ago. And I you know, there's the science behind it. So for me, it's more like a subliminal message to people. Like, the more they see those terms, whether it's cruelty-free or vegan or plant-based or plant-strong or whatever it is, it's like one of those things, the more you hear it, the more it becomes normal and not a weird thing.
Got it.
So, but I don't to me, they're all the same. I don't see them as all, you know, I know some people think vegan means you can't use, you know, soy, and I agree, but at the same time, I use them interchangeably for my company.
Got it. What about when you're at the trade shows? Like, do you, because I noticed, like, when I went to it was more of a food show. It was a natural organics show last year. And this was here in Sydney even. And the amount of people displaying their wares, they had the word vegan right up there, you know, on their banners and everything. And even some, like, the business owners themselves weren't necessarily vegan, but they recognized, like, the power of the word. So, and that's a big change from years ago when people would hide it. So, I mean, do you kind of broadcast it, or do you just kind of let people know, like you say, as they're kind of looking at the product? So I'm just curious about how prominently you use the word in your branding and marketing.
I would say kind of medium. I use it mediumly. Like, at trade shows, we obviously, you know, we'll have, it's on our hang tag. So, and then we explain the vegan leather. But we don't have a huge banner that, like, says vegan or anything like that. In fact, the very first vegan festival that I've ever done was only like a year ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, I'd never done one. And it was like, why haven't I been doing this? The people are so wonderful. It's just like, my people, like, it was just such a good vibe. Like, what did I do last year? I did the Vegan Beer Fest in Pasadena. It was so much fun. Just the energy and, the positivity, and it's a great community, you know, so it's kind of neat to kind of tap into that now, even though I've been around for 20 years, and be part of it.
So I love that. So I was going to ask you, who are your main customers? Obviously, they're not solely vegans.
No, they're not.
You've been running your business all this time. So what kind of people, who is your kind of key target market? What kind of people mostly buy your bag?
Well, it used to be like more like the college girl, the 20-something. But now, you know, I'll do a craft show and it's like the mom comes, the grandma comes, and the little girl comes. So you have three generations of people because, you know, who doesn't not like a little canvas bag with pigs on it? You know, it's the cuteness that sells itself and the quality. We have really good quality products. So, so kind of our customer is not just one. It kind of goes all over the place. And there are people who buy our bags just because we are a vegan, and there's others that don't, you know, so,
Yeah, no, for sure. No, that makes sense. So now you mentioned earlier when you first started out, you were handcrafting the bags yourself and you had a day job. At what point, Susie, were you able to work on Bungalow 360 full time as like your main business?
That was a real scary time because, you know, I was kind of living paycheck to paycheck. I didn't have a lot of money saved, so it wasn't like I could just go out and live and make ends meet. You know, I'd have to do it solely on my bags. So on the weekends I was doing it, and I finally just wasn't really happy in my job. And so I finally quit, and I just, I had to just go out there and do it. And what happens when, you know, obviously I saw potential and I saw sales, and I kind of did the math, but, what happens when you do that is then you have to do things that make sure that you are successful, you know, or else you don't pay rent, that kind of thing. And there was at one point I had like five credit cards with a, you know, $70,000 balance on it, trying to juggle everything, which I wouldn't recommend, but that's just the way I ended up doing it.
For sure. Excellent. Great. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I've had a couple of people I've interviewed who said something similar. It was like, literally, we've got our last, in fact, I interviewed somebody recently that's going to be on the show in a while, and they said they were down to their last $4,000. They were supposed to be moving house, and instead they invested it in this sales course because they knew they had to get really good at selling. And it was literally a kind of do or die moment. And, you know, it worked out well for them. And sometimes, yeah, you have to kind of take that plunge, and you don't have the luxury of sitting back and saying, oh, well, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. It's like, right, this has got to work, and I'm going to, you know, pull out all the stops to make that happen. Mm-hmm. So I certainly can.
It lights that fire where, oh, yeah, I'll do it next week. I'm going to do this instead. Like, you kind of know that this is it, you know, it's do or die. So.
Exactly. So, Susie, what advice would you give? So, to people like yourself who, you know, they've got their day job, they're quite creative, you know, they'd love to sort of, you know, make their own brand, whether it's bags or, you know, whatever, jewelry, whatever kind of creative endeavor they might do. What advice would you give them about, you know, what they need to take into account before making that jump from employment to self-employed?
I would come up with a business plan. And I would have some, you know, some backup and some, you know, some signs that the product is in demand and it's sellable. And have a backup plan, you know. But it's kind of hard to, like, you kind of know in your heart, like, oh, I'm just going to do this, or you don't. You know, like, if you go to a market and you don't sell anything, then I wouldn't quite quit my day job yet. But if you're at the point where you're so busy that you can barely do both jobs, then I would say go for it. You know, you can kind of see the signs of, oh, I'm onto something here. This is going to be good, you know? The way I always looked at it, like, I was like, well, if it doesn't work out, I can always go get another job. It's not, you know what I mean? It's not like it's the end of the world. You know, if it doesn't work out, you can always go back and get a job.
Okay. Yeah, for sure. Now, you touched on this a little bit earlier about funding the business, because obviously every business, you know, even an online only one, has got some startup costs. Whatever you're comfortable with sharing, and I know you've touched on that already, you had some credit cards in the beginning. What have been some of the methods you've used to get started and keep the business going?
I pretty much put whatever I made went back into the company. And so it kind of grew slowly. you know, that's why, you know, for 3 to 5 years, I can't really remember how long I was doing just the handcrafted, but it's because I was slowly building it. Like I would go out and do a craft fair, I'd make money, then I go buy fabric. And, you know, if you're someone who has a business plan and you have funding, then you probably wouldn't want to go that route unless you want to experience a lot of the nitty gritty of building a business from scratch, you know? So that's just, I would have loved to have someone say, oh, you have a great idea. Here's the funding. Go make a business. You know what I mean? But that's not how it happened for me. So that's kind of all I know is I didn't really have a budget to work with. I just kind of just went with my gut and followed like, oh, here's an event. I'm going to make stuff. And then I sell stuff. And then I go back and get fabric. It's kind of a, and just kept growing as I had more customers and more sales. But it's a slow process doing it that way.
Yeah. It's a different model, isn't it? There's that. And then there's obviously, of course, you know, investors. And then there's issues around, you know, how much of your company do you want to give up and that kind of thing.
Right.
So I guess it all comes down to what you feel comfortable with. And like you touched on earlier, how big or otherwise you want your business to be. So. Yeah, cool. So kind of final kind of couple of questions now. You touched on this earlier where you said, you know, there was one point in your business where, you know, you had the factory, I think it was in India you mentioned, and, you know, the product came back really poorly and you just kind of wanted to give up. And obviously, you know, you've got to have some certain qualities to run a business. You know, it forces you out of your comfort zone. There's lots of stress involved, you know, when things don't go right. So what personal qualities do you believe are essential to staying the course? Because you've definitely stayed the course and running a successful business.
Yeah, I think you have to have a sense of humor and be able to laugh at yourself. You need to be a real hard worker. I mean, I can't tell you how many mornings I get up at, you know, in the beginning would get up at 4 a.m., load my car, drive to L.A., unload my car, set up my booth. You know what I mean? So you just, I know some people like would not do that. And so you just have to have a real strong work ethic. And what else? And you don't be afraid to fail. You know, I look at all my failures as they opened the door to something that ended up being very successful. So, and just go for it. That's kind of
nice. Yeah, no, I like that. Do you do anything like to sort of maintain, you know, a strong emotional well-being, like, I don't know, meditation or sport or anything
like
that?
Does red wine count? No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. No, I do. I love to run long distance, but it is hard. It's super hard because for me, like I did CrossFit for 2 years. And I was like in the best shape I've ever been at. But it was, I mean, I had to get it. I got up 6 a.m. 5 days a week and I went to my hour class. But then we moved and that CrossFit isn't in my area anymore. So then I really had to, you know, it was really hard to get out and get back into it because I had to really be motivate myself. So, you know, I like to jump on a trampoline. I do rowing. I run. And I try to get it in the first thing in the morning because if I don't, it's the business sucks all my energy out and then it's just like, you know, but I'm a big, big believer into getting out in nature, not disconnecting from nature. And we're surrounded by avocado farms and stuff. So for me, it's part of, you know, being out in nature is still part of, you know, we have a pond that, we can go down to. That, you know, there's just so much wildlife and very inspiring. So,
Wonderful. It's interesting that you've made that move. Like you say, you're on the farm in the hill surrounded by nature and you're still able to operate your business, which I think is worth pointing out as well. And so do you still go, like, do you still personally like go to a lot of these trade shows? Like, do you still have to kind of come into the cities and what have you? Or is it mainly, you're mainly spending time at home and you've got your sales manager and reps going out to?
Yeah, I used to just up until a couple of years ago. I used to still travel to all the trade shows just because I like to go to New York. I like to go to Atlanta. You know, it was like a different space to be in. But now that we have our sales representative, he kind of goes and takes care of that. And he's a much better salesperson than I ever would be. I'm just not like a salesperson. I never have.
Well, you must be pretty good.
No, I was always about, if you like my product, buy it. If not, you know what I mean? I don't know how to sell my product. So we have a great sales guy that goes and does all the trade shows. And so I get kind of isolated and I do kind of miss that. But I mean, we're not that, we're 20 minutes from the nearest beach town, but just we're up in the hill. So, and we're on lots of acreage, cool. And we, you know, prior to that, we made the decision, oh, you could spend money on an office and hire a receptionist and have all these bills. But environmentally, it just makes sense to have solar panels that run your home and your business. We collect rainwater that, you know, feeds all the plants and all of that. So it's kind of a learning experience to be out here in that, you know.
For sure. And that's wonderful. I just think it's good for people to know that, you know, you don't necessarily always, I mean, maybe when you're starting out perhaps, but, you know, you don't always have to be, you know, right there in the thick of the city. You can kind of pretty much operate your business from everywhere. And you've obviously found a way to make it work in a really sustainable and holistic way, which is wonderful. So final question, what's your long-term vision for Bungalow 360 and for yourself?
Yeah.
If you have one.
Yeah, well, the whole farming thing, when we first moved here, I was like, I'm going to do a kale farm and I'm going to do basil and tomatoes. And I did not take into consideration the wildlife. Like, you plant kale, it's gone the next day. And so I've been struggling trying to grow stuff and it's been frustrating. But I finally had my first sales to some local chefs and I'm growing passion fruit. So we're going to kind of go full forward with turning that, the rest of the acreage into a passion fruit farm, because that's what we can grow here and the squirrels and the bunnies leave it alone. And for the business, it's just, I'm in that little sweet spot. So I kind of don't, you know, I don't see, oh, I need to grow. I don't need to, you know, everything's kind of perfect right now, but you know, you have to adapt because we don't know what the climate of the future holds with politics and all that kind of stuff can change things very quickly. So we're kind of always open to being adapted and, you know, we have to be resourceful and stuff like that going forward.
Got it. Wonderful. That's been fantastic. It's been really, really inspiring. I've thoroughly enjoyed hearing about your story and your journey and everything. It's been absolutely great. And I think particularly for people like yourself, you know, who come from that creative background, I think it's been really great for them to learn, you know, how to turn that into a business. Yeah, how to turn their passion into a business. So really appreciate you sharing everything you have, Susie. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
So that was Susie Push of Bungalow 360. You can find out more at bungalow360.com. And that link is on the show notes page at veganbusinessmedia.com/podcasts and going to episode 59. Now for our vegan business news roundup. The second annual Vegan Mac and Cheese Smackdown in Baltimore, Maryland, tripled its attendance from last year, reports the Baltimore Sun. Around 3,000 people came along to sample plant-based cheeses from 28 contestants that included both home cooks and caterers who brought their wares to the cook-off at Baltimore City Community College recently. The Smackdown was part of the inaugural Baltimore Vegan Weekend, a series of events throughout the city celebrating vegan cuisine. Hosted by Pep Foods, a local vegan collective, and Baltimore Vegan Drinks, the event featured a mix of repeat contestants from last year, along with new ones. Some participants used vegan cheese created by well-known brands such as Daiya and Miyoko's Kitchen, while others created their own nut-based versions. Brenda Sanders, one of the event's organisers, attributed the growth of the event to the appeal of the vegan lifestyle. She said, "Folks are just ready to try something different. This whole health movement is really picking up steam in Baltimore right now."
So I love mac and cheese. And to be honest, I can't really be bothered to make it myself because, as you'll know, if you're a regular listener to this podcast, the kitchen is not my domain. So I totally approve of these vegan mac and cheese smackdowns where I can enjoy other people's creations. And this is a great initiative that can be replicated in other cities. So maybe have a think about how you could get involved in organizing something like that in your own city. Canadian packaged meat company Maple Leaf Foods has acquired US plant protein firm Lightlife for $140 million, reports Food Business News. Established in 1979, Lightlife has a 38% share in the US refrigerated plant-based protein foods category and turned over around $40 million in sales in 2016. It manufactures more than 30 products, including tempeh, hot dogs, breakfast foods and burgers, at its facility in Massachusetts. Brynwood VI acquired the brand from ConAgra Foods in 2013. And since then, the company has significantly expanded its sales, production and profitability, according to Brynwood Partners. Michael McCain, president and CEO of Maple Leaf Foods, says the move is part of the company's growth strategy. So we're continuing to see more of this, meat companies buying up or buying shares in plant-based businesses. It certainly goes to show how popular the plant-based category is becoming. How it plays out for animals and the environment in the long run remains to be seen. The world's largest coconut water brand has ventured into the dairy-free milk market and expects to approach $1 billion in sales this year, reports Bloomberg News. All Market, the parent company of Vita Coco, has branched out into coconut milk, coconut oil and other products. They've done this in response to consumers continuing to seek out healthy alternatives to supermarket staples. Sales of regular milk declined in the US between 2011 and 2016, but plant-based alternatives, including coconut milk, have gone up 61%. Vita Coco coconut milk is set to launch in March, first at the Safeway supermarket chain and then at other grocers and independent retailers. The company's expansion has resulted in large beverage companies showing an interest in potentially acquiring it in order to tap into the growth of the dairy-free sector. So this is another example of the growth in plant-based milks, and I still can't quite get over the fact that in 20 years since I went vegan, we've gone from having just one or two soy-based options to a multitude of dairy-free alternatives. And the more we can wean people off cow's milk and other animal-based milks and onto plant-based milks, the better. So this is pretty exciting stuff. Finally, Lisa Frank, a US brand known for producing whimsical commercial design for school supplies and other products that are marketed mostly to children, is getting ready to launch a range of vegan cosmetics, reports Veg News. The line is a collaboration between Frank and Glamour Dolls Makeup and will feature iconic imagery such as Technicolor unicorns, dolphins and bears. This will be Frank's first venture into adult products. The line will include 6 items: a blush brush, lip balm, matte mousse, liquid liner, unicorn lippy, highlight powder, and vegan leather makeup bag. A crowdfunding campaign on Kickstarter has already raised $50,000 more than its original goal, and it provides customers with the opportunity to engage with the final product development. Backers will be able to vote on product names, pick shades, and get behind-the-scenes looks at how Glamour Dolls' Jessica Romano, who's the lead makeup designer for the project, develops vegan cosmetics. So that's a really handy thing if you're in the beauty business to get that behind the scenes look. So this is yet another example of the beauty industry heading in a positive direction with more brands and celebrities making their lines vegan. And this really helps to mainstream vegan products and breaks down the stereotypes that vegan living can't be glamorous. You know, I personally love my bling and my sparkle and my red lippy. So I love the fact that more and more cosmetics are becoming cruelty-free. Fantastic. So that's it for this episode of Vegan Business Talk. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed the show, I'd really appreciate it if you gave it a review and rating on iTunes or any other platform you're listening on. Finally, I encourage you to head over to veganbusinessmedia.com, where you can find more resources, including details of my media and PR consultations, copywriting, editing, and proofreading services to help you grow your vegan business. I'm Katrina Fox, author of Vegan Ventures, Start and Grow an Ethical Business. And I look forward to catching up with you in the next episode of Vegan Business Talk. Bye for now.
If you enjoyed this podcast, also check out the Vegan Business Tribe podcast with myself, David Pennell. And you can find that on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, as well as the video version on YouTube too. And if you want to be part of the most amazing community of vegan business owners from around the world, then come and sign up with us at veganbusinesstribe.com to get all the support you need to grow a successful vegan business.